Oh, yeah. Here we go. Practice acquisition. There are pitfalls throughout the entire process.
Hey guys, thanks again for joining us. This is Dental Acquisition Uncensored, and we are in the middle of Shark Week. Here we go. Another great episode coming from NorCal, Northern California. And we're, again, brokers across the entire country. In this particular episode, it didn't go 100% in the direction that I thought it was going to. But Tim, my new next guest, man, he drops a ton of great information. He's a fast talker. We had some connection issues, so hang in there. But we talked about, you know, what a unicorn practice really looks like. We talked about the Delta issues with PPO and fee-for-service and buying practices in California and Delta Premier and all that craziness. Talk about how to actually qualify what a good practice is to buy and not. And then what was really interesting at the end was we talked about how your professionals can actually get you into trouble on these deals. Everybody talks about how you got to have the best professionals on your team, but Tim's right. Nobody talks about how professionals can really screw up your deal. So stay tuned, hang in there towards the end because we get to that. And that's a real thing. Professionals can screw up the deal. Let's get it going.
Acquisition Uncensored. The truth when buying and selling a dental practice. And now your host, Michael Dincio.
Okay, everyone. Thanks so much for joining another great episode here on Acquisition Uncensored. We're in the middle of Shark Week and we're having a lot of fun. If this is your first episode for Shark Week, this is Practice Brokers Shark Week. It's a week of the top practice brokers in the country from coast to coast. And today we have a special guest and friend of mine who covers the Northern California market, some of Arizona and a tad bit in Nevada. And Tim, you can help me if I screwed that up, but it's Tim Giroux with Western Practice Sales, a former past president of ADS, which for those of you that don't know ADS is a national brokers group or affiliation, and maybe Tim could get into that, but this guy is legendary and we got lucky to have him on the program. So Tim, thanks for being on, brother.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks.
So Tim, you cover NorCal. And you're the guy there, and NorCal and California in general. And you know what? I'll even take that one step further is the coasts are often challenging markets in practice sales for a lot of reasons. They tend to sell for higher and all kinds of things like that. But the coasts and particular NorCal can be a challenging market. And we're going to get into some of that. But Tim, you dominate in that market. And so tell us a little bit about Western Practice Sales and the company that you have started but have been running for years.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. It's been around. Western Practice Sales has been around about 40 years, believe it or not. And John Noble, who's still with me, was one of the main brokers back in the day. I got out of dental school in 83, moved out here in 2000 and around 2001. Anyway, the guy that used to own Western Practice Sales was a past associate dean of University Pacific. And I was going to get my license here. And I was going to take the board, and they introduced me to Bob Gartrell, who introduced me to the deans at UOP who were going to get me patients. And he goes, "Hey, you want to sell some dental practices before you get your license?" I go, "Sure, why not?" You know, and in about 4 months, I go, "Hey, you want to sell me this business so I don't have to take the board?" And he goes, "Yeah, you work for me another year and I'll sell you the business." And so that's how I just kind of fell into owning Western Practice Sales as of 2001. So, I feel like, first of all, I'm a dentist. My wife's a dentist. We practiced together in Scottsdale for almost 20 years. And then my daughter just got out of dental school 4 years ago, and she's been a Navy dentist for the last 4 years, and she married one of her classmates. So my son-in-law is a dentist, so plenty of dentists still in the family. I had one other kid, a son who was an investment banker. So we all joke that he was a smart one out of us, all of us dentists, and a non-dentist. So,
an ex-banker, he is not the smart one. I can promise you that.
Yeah, he's in a pretty good arena down in LA. Both kids went to UCLA, and Amy went to Loma Linda Dental School. And that's why I really enjoy, interacting with the buyers, because basically, I have a love for that. Obviously, us brokers, for the most part, always represent sellers, but we spend all our time and money trying to cultivate a database of buyers to try to make the perfect match, contrary to the ADEPT program in the ADA. I mean, we've been doing that forever. It's not like we haven't been. And since we have one of the best databases out here, and some of that has, to do with our affiliation with ADS being a national portal that spends a lot of budget on those things, we try to cultivate, the most amount of buyers possible so we could make that best match for anybody that lists their practice with us. And, I've got a DDS, John has an MBA, John has an MBA, and Ed has a JD and a CPA. So we kind of feel like we're, at the top level, as far as we're just not some brokers that got out of high school and thought we'd do real estate and then sell dental practices. So, we've been around for a long time. And it's we're busy. We probably did 130 practices last year.
Wow.
Ever done.
Okay. So folks, let me, and Tim, I'm going to interrupt you, and I'm sorry, but I need permission there. But when you say something that sparks something, 130 practices, folks, is a lot, like a lot of practice sales. And so just to give you an indication of and that's a great question, by the way, to ask a broker, how many practices did you guys transition last year? Because I'm going to tell you that a lot of you may not know who the quote unquote biggest players are in the market. And so that would be a quick question that you could ask a broker, is how many did you guys work with? If they say five, well, they probably don't have a lot of listings. But if someone says 130, like Tim just said, that's somebody that you want to call a lot and make sure that, hey, Tim, if you have a practice in this particular area, think of me. That's a place that should spark something in you. So that's a lot, Tim. Congratulations. That's great.
Oh, thanks. Well, again, that's interesting, because as a, I still feel like as a dentist first, I tell all my young dentists, they got to call every broker in the area that has a practice. And, I always say, hopefully it's mine, but if it's my competitors and it's a practice that fits you, go buy it. I mean, it's kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. Now, they can ask me some questions, but they're better off if they give you a call and ask you some questions and just do some of the basics, as you and I have done in the past, looking at different practices. But again, I think that's the unique part. I mean, I'll tell every young buyer, call every broker in your area. Mm-hmm. And if sellers are listening to this, they go, oh yeah, they'll hear that. Oh, can I present personalized attention? Well, yeah. I mean, I quarterback so many, John quarterbacks so many, Ed quarterbacks so many of my other guys. I mean, so you always have a personal touch, and we have a phenomenal staff, as Mike can attest through the deals. I mean, boy, when you ask a question and need a document, bam, we have it instantly. So, So I think we run a pretty, good machine, where a lot of guys, they're a one-man show. They're trying to do everything on their own. We have this amazing database, with one touch of a button, I can put a practice out to 4,000, 5,000 dentists in one touch in an instant, So that's why we're trying to cultivate this database for the buyers, and it helps the sellers. But again, that whole matching thing that, ADEPT kind of thinks that, us brokers are missing. No, we have every intention of making a good fit. The question is, what is a good fit? And you'll be getting into that, because that's kind of what you're trying to help these buyers do. So
yeah, no, that kind of leads me right to my first question, though, Tim, is this whole program, we're going through the start to the finish of an acquisition, and we've already talked about banking, and we've talked about understanding your vision and what you're trying to accomplish. But the thing that's really interesting is that the practice brokers, if you haven't heard that, folks, in the whole series of Shark Week, is these practice brokers want a successful transition. That's what they want. They don't want to sell you something and then it fail. Like, that's the worst possible scenario. And so I guess my first question to you is when you do get these calls from the buyers, what's that conversation going to sound like? And is there a difference between some buyers versus other buyers? And walk me through that scenario, because I gotta believe that you're attracted as a broker to certain buyers than others. Let's talk about that. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure about that last one. I kind of have a reputation of being very frank, blunt, and honest. But having said that, you've seen our financial package, and you know, and I'll say this, and people kind of chuckle because they hear it a lot. But you know, I'm helping my son-in-law look at practices out in North Carolina now when my daughter finishes off her Navy gig. And as far as I'm concerned, my financial package has everything you would need to make a reasonable decision on that. The point is that, you know, I write these articles. One of my favorites is, you know, the $1 million question. I think, you know, you can help these buyers basically get through this information, because, you know, I didn't even know these reports existed when I was a practicing dentist. So my daughter always teases me, "Dad, well, this is what you do for a living now." And I go, "You know, you're right. I didn't run all these reports as a practitioner. So I'm trying to educate my buyers how to begin the process of what they're looking for. And, you know, so that procedure code analysis, the procedures are there. To me, the profi count, exam count towards production, you know, there's a range that you're going to start to see when you look at 150 practices a year, like I do, you know, and then, you know, and I can look at a practice and kind of go, "Wow, if I took that over, I know what my skill sets were, I'm going to kill it." And I look at other practices and kind of go, "Wow, I never did surgical implants. I never did ortho. I hated molar endo. I loved, you know, partial bony extractions and soft tissues." But I mean, we all have our own, you know, kind of skill sets, but that's part of that package. And so that's where you start to kind of try to decipher this process. And so I'm frustrated, to be honest with you now, Mike, is that some of these guys, you know, they hire an attorney that knows nothing about dentistry and nothing about the business of dentistry. And they start asking questions that have nothing to do to answer the biggest part of the due diligence, is that, is this a good match for me based on my skill sets, number one, and, you know, and my diagnosing? You know, some people, you know, we have an opinion that they overdiagnose. Well, they think they're Goldilocks. They think they're perfect. And, you know, and I kind of got past making that judgment after I started doing so many. I mean, I used to judge like, "Wow, this guy's really an aggressive diagnoser," or, "Wow, this guy's really too conservative. Man, he ought to be doing more dentistry here." Well, that's my opinion as a dentist. You can put a patient in between, in a room of me and my wife, my daughter, my son-in-law, a couple of my classmates. We'll have 10 different treatment plans, you know, and that's going to make a huge difference in this practice that we would purchase, you know, based on. So how you help these guys get there. But even at the end of the day, you know, they got to look at that chart and kind of go, "Ah, that guy doesn't diagnose anything." Or they got to look at that chart and go, "Whoa, you know, I mean, I'm looking at a bunch of occlusal fill-ins and there's, you know, 15 crowns after that." It's like, "Man, that's not, you know, that looks crazy." You know, the thing is with those kind of practices, you don't, you know, make a low ball offer. You run away, you know, it's something like that. But so, I mean, you need somebody like Mike to kind of coach you through that. But at the end of the day, you got to own your decision. And to me, you know, Mike is beneficial in helping you find this $1 million question. What am I going to be able to do with this patient base in my own hands? And, you know, an accountant doesn't know that. An attorney doesn't know that. At least, you know, somebody like Mike knows how to look at these reports and kind of help decipher, you know, and help you understand, you know, maybe where you fit in this Goldilocks, you know, this range of, and we're never exactly alike, you know, I mean, so maybe you do Invisalign and the guy doesn't, you know, maybe you, or you can kind of tell you do some molar endo now and he doesn't. Well, maybe his skill sets as far as communication and selling treatment plans are better than yours. Well, they should be after 40 years, you know, compared to years, 2 years out of school. So you're never going to match. So.
I found that like, you're going off on that topic, and I love that, because I found that just because it doesn't fit you perfectly. Okay, so you did 5-10 cases of Invisalign. Just because you don't do Invisalign, the impact of 5-10 cases is not that big of a deal, right? And so my job half the time as a buyer's rep is to really analyze the true impact, because half the time it's not as big as you might think, you know?
Yeah. You get rid of, you know, some of the surgical implants, or you get rid of whatever, some molar endo that you say you're not going to do or whatever, or the, you know, soft tissue impactions that you don't want to touch. But then you kind of look at, well, gosh, I'd probably be doing some of these other things instead. But
yeah,
the point is, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's kind of like this gut feel. I mean, and again, it really is more of a gut feel that, that you're, I don't say aggressiveness or whatever the case is, your opinion on what needs to be done compared to what you could watch and things like that. If that, somewhat close to matches. I mean, if you're, the funny thing is the accountants and the attorneys will see what I would call the really overly aggressive guy. You know, guess what? His tax return looks fantastic. You know what I mean? He's making a ton of money. This looks like the best practice ever. And so all these consultants, you just paid $5,000 to go look at this stuff, say, oh, wow, this is awesome. Well, by golly, you know, guess what? It's awesome on paper. But I mean, yeah. The point is, it comes down to, you know, can you do the work? I mean, so again, it's so funny because, what we're trying to avoid is that mismatch of skill sets and the diagnosing aspect of what, you think needs to be done on these treatment plans. And so again, guess what? Only the dentist really can do that. When I lump all these consultants, I'm not trying to lump Mike into that, because at least, my dental consultants that are used to looking at these reports can kind of at least help look at these things and steer, the doctor to take a look at some of these issues to say, okay, do you do the smaller end of deal? And Mike has a feel like when you see everybody has, active patients. I don't know if you want to just keep me rambling and you're just going to interrupt me whenever you want.
there's some really good stuff in there. So keep rambling. I'll cut you off. Yeah, this is perfect. Okay. Keep going. Yeah.
Active patients. I mean, Wells Fargo still tells their clients to ask for active patient counts. We have it all in our material never to give that number, because I can count a totally different number than anybody, is the point. What's that mean? I think it's anybody's been in your office at least once in 2 years. Some people say it's a year and a half. Some people say, well, it's only, you count them only if they're in an active recall. Well, some of my best referring patients only showed up once every 5 years because they hated the dentist but loved me, and they referred like the entire neighborhood to me, and they wouldn't be considered an active patient. So the point is, I mean, I don't think that number is not a tangible number, but, exam counts and prophy counts they're right there. And so start looking at your exam and prophy counts compared to production. And then you'll start going, oh, this guy did 1,000 prophys last year and 1,000 exams, and he produced 700,000. That's kind of my average number. I had a practice, a great guy, went to my school, but he did Invisalign, he did straight wire, he did implants, he did molar endo. I mean, there was not one thing this guy referred out. He did 700, exams a year and did 1.2. Well, he wasn't a charlatan overdiagnoser. He just had skill sets that I didn't have, So again, I'm pretty confident dentist. I look back and go, well, I'd be lucky to do, basically I'd be lucky to do 800,000 out of that practice. Would I make my offer on that? Yeah. You'd have to.
Let's talk about that for a second. So what you're doing, Tim, is you're kind of, I think there's a lot to be said for as a buyer approaches, and you're doing it with your daughter and your son-in-law, and you're approaching these practice brokers, prospectuses or reports. And in a lot of ways, they're very subjective. And, there's the quality level of these prospectuses can range vastly. And I'm not saying this.
Yeah.
Because I'm not saying this because you're on the show. Your prospectus is definitely one of my favorites because it gives me all the meat and potatoes. I would say that's not very common. And now that you've been looking with your daughter, you probably realize too that it's the quality is just totally off. But the practice broker does the best they can in representing the practice that they have. And like I just said, that the range of the prospectus is different. But at the end of the day, if we could oversimplify this, is exactly what you're saying, is it always comes back to the fit for you and that particular practice. And you as a buyer versus another buyer are all going to look at it differently. That's what I'm hearing you say.
But the bottom line is, again, we're all about, you know, you want a good match, you know, I mean, so you and I talked about this other issue we can bring up, but the same thing, it's, you know, the Delta Dental in California, I mean, it's other states, but that one issue is not, that'll be some people run away screaming with their hair on fire, which you see happen all the time. You know, some accountants in some banks, you know, kind of, you know, start the buyer's hair on fire and tell them to run and scream and, you know, hit the panic button. I mean, honestly, I wouldn't buy a practice that wasn't Delta Premier. That's my honest opinion. Why is that? Nicest patients. They appreciate quality work, you know. Now, having said that, I'm not going to let my daughter's son-in-law be a Delta provider in California. I would never let them work for a $750 crown. That's bullshit. Sorry, my French. You can edit that out. But, you know, it's just, you know, everybody should say no to Delta, you know, and this whole thing at this grandfather in is just a stealth secret way to screw all you young buyers from Delta. They'll tell you that, oh, yeah, of course you're going to be both. You're going to be a premier provider and a DPO provider. Well, 96% of their clients are on the cheaper fee schedule. And my sellers don't quite understand that they get paid 100% of their clients get paid on the premier fee schedule. Now, having said that, there's a way to transition to be out of network. I know there's issues. I don't want to get deep into the weeds on that, but they haven't raised that premier fee schedule for 5, 6, 7 years. That premier fee schedule is usually 25% less than most of my guys' quality practices UCR already. So they're already taking a hit with the premier fee schedule, much less to take another 30% hit to go to the crappy fee schedule. So again, I mean, all of us dentists have to basically say no to Delta. And, you know, guess what? I think they'll come around someday, but it only stops when you tell them no, you know? And so they've got such a control going on, you know, I, you know, send the checks to the patients, but there's ways to get around those things. But the narrative would be like, hey, we'll honor this fee schedule that haven't been raised in 6 years. And the patient should go, what? The fees hasn't been raised in 6 years? That's impossible. There's inflation going on. Yeah, I know. This fee schedule is already 3% my usual fee schedule. No kidding, doctor, but you're going to honor that for me? Yes. Well, yeah, guess what? The payment from Delta is going to be less than they anticipated unless they are one of those few premier. But I mean, again, at some point, unless you want to race to the bottom with crappy fees, you just have to say no. And eventually, don't you want the patients that appreciate quality work and want to see you and are happy to pay whatever $200-$300 extra for a crown every once in a while to get a nice quality crown from you? That's who you want to go to every day in your profession for the next 30 years. Do you really want to go to somebody that doesn't care who you are and could give a crap, but you know, whatever, and you know, just wants a crown for $700? That's the guy you want to target your practice to? I hope not. I mean, if you're really fast and you have some cheap lab in Taiwan, you can make it work. But I mean, again, it's your call. So
let's talk about that. I'll chime in on that. So we've had a lot of conversations about Delta over, I guess we could say, the years now, where it is a concern. I think this is a national program. We're in California talking to Tim Giroux in Western Practice Sales, and he is in California, and Delta is very difficult to work with in California. In Washington State, they're being very amicable on these fees and matching some of the sellers' fee schedules, and it's different across the whole country, and I don't think everybody really does understand that. So it is a state-by-state type situation. But with that all being said, Tim's making a great argument for going to fee for service versus staying and playing the insurance game. And I think it comes down to Tim, Doc, like, to me, it's more about, does the buyer have the ability or does the team have the ability to have a good solid conversation with the patient and walk the patient through the actual process of insurance and what it actually means to them and how it's going to actually affect their pocketbook. If you have the skill to have effective communication and you have your team has the skill level to have effective communication, you've got a better chance at fighting this problem. Would you agree with that? Like, it's all about communication.
Well, it's all about communication. I mean, I wish my sellers would, you know, dump the delta a year prior to selling their practice and just, you know, them do it. It would be a better situation, but that's part of the process. I'm going through one of these now. We're just going to, once we get a agreed upon price and get through things, we're going to ask the seller to start that process before we even announce to the patients that we're going to have a sale. And you know, and then, yeah, the seller's going to stick around, do some surgical implants, and we'll have some nice things as far as that goes. But so it's all about the conversation, and so the patients need to understand that, you know, dentistry is not supposed to be for free. Obviously, you know, Mike and I went through Mike and I went through a transition not too long ago, and one of the most expensive neighborhoods in the country. And, you know, of course, this discussion came up, but why in the world, if you're in like the most affluent neighborhood in the entire world, practically, that you would want to do a crown for $800, you know, I mean, that's just, and I think the buyer decided that she was going to try that for a while. And I'm thinking like, why in the world would you do that? I mean, because, you know, this was the misinformation I think we gave years ago, and we were all kind of guilty of it. We told the buyers to go along with it, take the cut. And after a year or two, when you get to know these patients, then maybe raise your fee. But, you know, I think that's the wrong approach, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, once you already take the cut, you've already kind of told them what your crown's worth, you know, and then the whole point of this is, like, let's say in this neighborhood, you know, most of the crowns are going for $1,400 to $1,500, let's say, you know, and Delta's paying $1,150. So you're already at a 30% cut already. And then you cut it down to $800. And then what, in 2 years, you're going to tell them, oh, but by the way, my crown fee is double now compared to what you've been paying. I mean, so, you know, again, this, I think, unfortunately, you know, the idea was to have the buyer get to know the patients first. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think you just need the seller support in that first, is my humble opinion on this. Are you going to lose some patients? Of course you are. But do you really want to work for $800 a crown?
Yeah.
For your whole life? Because at some point, aren't you going to have to make that decision how far to the, you know, some of these practices, I mean, some of the other the PPOs pay better than the crappy Delta. You know, they'll pay even what the Delta Premier fee schedule is. Maybe you choose to keep those. But, you know, I mean, again, at some point, you gotta decide when to say no. And again, it could be neighborhood. I mean, if you're in other places, I'll say East San Jose, well, yeah, I mean, the crown, there's a lot of people race to the bottom there. You have to figure out how to, if that's your turf, you got to figure out how to play that game, no matter what, basically what it comes down to. So it is kind of a case by case basis.
And it always will be. There's never going to be something that we say on this program or in a book or some seminar. You're going to get generic information, folks, but it really is a case by case. That's why some of these Facebook, forums where I see people giving free advice, and free advice is free advice. I mean, you get what you pay for. And in a lot of cases, even this program could be considered free advice. It's a case by case, folks. Like Tim's suggestions today are really related to NorCal. Don't take those to Kansas City. It's going to be different, right? And so you gotta really weigh your scenario. Everybody has their own scenario. But Tim, let's transition real quick. I've been having the conversation with all of the practice brokers on the program, and it's this conversation of like a well-oiled machine practice throwing off tons of cash, the unicorn practice that everybody wants, versus the fixer-upper, so to speak. And it's that conversation of like, what do you get with either one? And you know, the reality is everybody wants the unicorn, and there are only so many of those, right? So then the conversation then should go into, well, what the other practices, what's good about the other practices? Because you only get so many of the unicorns, and there's going to be a line out the door to buy those, and they're going to be paid. Someone's going to pay way over value, quote unquote, way over value for those unicorn, right? Because that's what everybody wants. But then the question is like, how do you make one of these average bread and butter practices or the fixer uppers work? Like, do you get into these conversations with buyers? I'm sure you do all the time.
Well, you know, that what's interesting about that is that again, that, I mean, we might have a different definition of unicorn on some of that too, but you know, the obviously, from what I just said there, you know, comparing, like I said, you know, I have other practice. Well, I have about four articles that I think are the best articles for my buyers. And it kind of addresses that through a couple of them and overlaps a little bit. But the point is, you know, I had a practice that was doing like, you know, $350,000 one time in San Jose. And I priced it at like $325,000 and people thought I was nuts, you know? And the reason I did is because it was like a 50-year-old practice. The father sold it to his son. The son really didn't want to be a dentist. He was going into real estate. You could just tell he just didn't do anything in this practice. This practice probably had 2,000 active patients, let's say, maybe back in the day, you know, we counted them, you know, like that or whatever. I mean, I could tell. Well, the first year, the buyer, you know, I pointed that out. All her experts told her not to buy it. It was overpriced. And, you know, I went in there, showed her everything. We went over the reports. It was like, if you don't do $800,000 out of here your first year, I mean, I'll buy you a steak dinner kind of a thing. And sure enough, she first year she buys it, she does like $900,000. Well, you know, again, is that the unicorn? No, that's not the unicorn you're talking about. It was a dump, you know. Things had been fixed up for 40 years. It was the fixer upper for $325,000. But the point is, again, if you got to know what you're looking at, you know. So when you're just telling your accountant to look at this tax return, you know, he doesn't know how to look at the charts, records, and see what's really there. So again, that's, you know, that's some of the whole point of this, you know, it's up to the dentist to kind of understand that. And, you know, and so many of them think they just have to listen to every word, every syllable their attorney tells them or their accountant tells them. And again, you're the one that's best person to be able to make that determination on that. So now if you have a practice that doesn't have this healthy patient base and you're in a spot, you know, that there's some competition and it's only throwing off 500,000 collections and, you know, maybe that's what it should be. There's a decent, you know, maybe the patient count's a little higher possibly. So you think you have a little room to grow. I mean, I'm not going to tell you how you can grow practice. I see people do scratch charts. I see them do that. I would probably refer them more to somebody like Mike or somebody in the territory that, you know, has had experience. What marketing works in that area? I mean, have you done the demographics to say this is your spot? I mean, again, if this is, you know, you're making a 30-year decision. If this is, you know, the school district you want your kids to be in or close to it, or, you know, it's close to home. I mean, there's all so many other factors to me that, you know, should make up this decision. But as far as somebody telling you that, yeah, I think I think you're going to get 40 new patients a month in here. All you got to do is show up. Well, I don't say that. You know, I just don't know what to say. But do I see people actually do that sometimes? Yeah, I do. I wish I knew that exact secret sauce, but that's not the business I'm in. So,
yeah, no, it's an interesting thing. Like most of my buyers, they want specific things, and I hear all the time from practice brokers, they're looking for a unicorn. They're looking for a unicorn. And to your point, people's definitions of unicorns are different, but the truth is it is a case by case scenario. There's a lot to go into the decision, geographical lifestyle, competition, you as a producer. I mean, there's 100 things, but I think what you're going to find in all of these episodes with all the practice brokers and Shark Week is you got to have a game plan for how you're going to take the practice and run with it. You got to have a game plan, and whether it's a fixer upper or a well-oiled machine, still you got to have a game plan post transition. That's been the overwhelming advice from all of these interviews, Tim, and you're saying the same thing.
Go ahead. You got to know yourself. I mean, you know, I was kind of talking about you know, want that perfect practice with all these nice patients that really like you. Well, guess what? I mean, there's a lot of us dentists that don't have a personality, that don't really like to talk to people, and you know, they can't even see themselves in, you know, doing that. Well, you know, guess what? That PPO practice where the patients are going there because of the PPO, and hey, you're pretty good with your hands. You know how to run a business. That could be the best thing you ever do. You know, I mean, you know, my practice was more personality based. Enjoy that. You know, my wife and I both could talk to people. It was fun. You know, they're like first name basis things. That's not everybody's practice, right? So again,
shocker. Hey, Tim. Shocker, Tim, that your practice was the personality practice. No, sorry, I cut you off, but yeah.
but you know, don't you know, if you're a square peg, don't put yourself into a round hole. I'm not saying that on either, whatever that means, you know, I'm not trying to say, but that's the thing, you know? And of course I think that's, you know, the square pegs and the round pegs are basically hiring all these same people to basically tell them, oh yeah, that's a great practice to buy. And again, looks like it on paper, but boy, you gotta own that decision. The million-dollar question: what are you gonna do with this? But it gets back to what you say: you have to have your game plan, and then at least recognize what you're looking at. You know, look at those prophy counts, those patient counts. Look at what procedures are being done, and look, you know, and make some kind of determination on that. How you're diagnosing skills and aggressive nature can, you know, relates to theirs. And of course, it's easier for a more of aggressive diagnoser with more skill sets to go into a practice that where the guy's not and he's referring a lot of things out. Yeah, that's not necessarily a unicorn, but certainly that's your kind of your game plan. You can just look at the patient base that's there and the amount of work that's being done and know that you bring more to the table that's being done. And again, then you might look at one where it's the opposite. Maybe it's in your perfect neighborhood. It's in exactly this, your kid's school district and everything else. Well, your choices are you can spend $500,000 for a buildup in there with zero patients, zero revenue, nothing there. People still do that. I don't even know why. I think that's crazy. You know, or, you know, maybe you pay $500,000 for this and it's only doing $500 a year. Well, guess what? What's a better investment? $500,000 at 100% gross receipt of the practice with, you know, that would be maybe, you know, 600 patients or whatever that would be, or starting with nothing, you know, and it was zero patients and trying to meet, you know. So again, it's interesting, you know, what are you trying, you know, if this is your best, you know, this is your sweetheart location, that trumps a few things too. And if they want 100% for their practice and it's going to go for that because it's in Cupertino next to Google or something like that, well, you know, yeah, if you want to be in that neighborhood, you know, it's like buying a house there. You can't, you know, if the houses are going for $2 million and you only have $1 million to buy a house, well, you're in the wrong neighborhood, you know. So all those things kind of come up.
Tim, you
can't put yourself into positions where you think you can do better, you know. So
no, that's perfect. That's been a common theme throughout the series. I want to finish on this question, and I don't want the audience to get. I've known Tim for a while now. I understand where he's coming from with the comments, but I could say this for Tim. By no means does he think you shouldn't have advisors or accountants or CPAs helping you. But I do want to cover this topic that I agree with Tim. It's why I'm a buyer's rep. You're going to have advisors, bankers, CPAs, attorneys. He made some, hell, even some consultants that are only going to look at the things on paper, the black and white. And you're 1,000% right. That if I get a piece of paper with a bunch of data on it, it doesn't take a genius to tell you, oh, this practice is profitable, you should buy it. Right? That's super easy. Folks, be careful about the team that you do hire. I think that's a valuable lesson actually to talk about on this episode.
Well, I think it's good because, you know, again, I appreciate you saying that because that's the takeaway. Something that I'll hear, I'll get, you know, five attorneys call me in the next week about that. and that's not my point. You know, the point is that, you know, you should have your team, but you are the CEO of your team. And so you need to control them if they're giving you advice. And I just had a seller the other day tell me, Tim, you know, I mean, me and this buyer got along great. It was a fantastic transition. He thanked me. It's going wonderful. And he said, you know, and we were getting along great. The buyer and seller forever. We both eventually fired the attorneys and just used your contract. And it was awesome. Now, I mean, some attorneys started so many fights, you know, between the guys. And of course, that's how these sellers look at it too. These buyers hire an attorney. They totally write up all this crazy stuff in the contract that they're protecting them with. And the seller's looking at this going, oh my God, you know, I mean, you know, so then he has to hire an attorney to beat some of the stuff back because some of it should be beat back. And then all of a sudden the fight's on. And all of a sudden these guys are getting along fantastic, you know, aren't getting along anymore. You know, and that's, I don't see my attorneys understanding that enough sometimes. You know, I know they want to protect their client, but this is a relationship. And guess what, buyers? You're buying relationships. You're buying the relationship between the doctor and those 1,000 or 2,000 patients or whatever there are. And, you know, the most important thing you're buying is that relationship and that goodwill. And if you're the CEO, if you're kind of seeing these changes that they're making, and A, you don't understand them, but B, you should have enough common sense to know that they're kind of antagonistic, you know, you're the CEO. Tell your guy, you know, maybe you need to back off a little bit. Can you explain why I have to be so harsh about this, or why that needs to be changed? I mean, let's talk about reality here. What's the chances of that really happening? Do we really have to make this an issue? You know, you're the CEO. This is your company. These are your advisors that you hired. My frustration is I see these guys spend $5,000-$10,000 on due diligence. And honestly, sometimes they kill a deal that would have been fantastic, you know, and I'm thinking like, well, whatever, you know, it's just, this is, nobody wants anybody to buy the wrong practice, but as a buyer, you got to take control of the situation and understand what's going on here. And again, you know, sometimes there's a nice practice with a seller I don't trust. You know, honestly, I'll probably mention somewhere along the line, well, you know, you got to be careful. Maybe, you know, I mean, it's not, and I'm not, you know, everything's not rainbows and unicorns.
I couldn't agree.
Mike, that's not going to always happen. But the point is, you know, the point is, you know, the due diligence is so important. Your team is important, but understand that you have to learn how to filter out the noise and determine what is important to answer the question of what you're going to be able to do with that patient base. That's the million-dollar question. And you have to be the CEO to filter out noise to be able to make a good decision. And if you can't filter out some of the noise that you're going to get, I mean, and they're not intentionally giving you bad noise, but that's just how they're trained. You know, attorneys are trained in an adversarial system. That's how they're trained. Understand that, right? Your accountant's going to be kind of like that too. He thinks he has to look up all the bad things that he sees on this balance sheet or something like that. And again, even when they bless it, sometimes they're blessing a balance sheet of a guy that overdiagnoses everything. So understand that ultimately you have to understand you're the CEO and how to process all this information you're going to get from your team.
I think that's really good. And that's spot on, because I think that's a great place to end this episode, because
I can talk for three hours. You want to end this?
I know you could. I can tell you're having a lot of fun, but I think that's a really, really good place to end, because it's a really important point in that. Don't rely 100% on your advisors. Listen to them. Don't be stupid and not listen. But at the same time, this is kind of like your first act as a business owner, and have some ownership in the process is ultimately kind of what I'm hearing Tim say, is like, don't just blindly lead even me, you know, a dental consultant buyer rep. Ask me questions. If you don't understand it, filter it through your own filter and own the process, because I don't know everything. I'm not naive to know that. Your attorney doesn't know everything. I mean, at the end of the day, you do need to take some ownership in the process. And I think that will do a lot of good. I always say to my clients, don't let the professionals screw this deal up for you. Don't let that happen. If you love this practice and it's a good fit for you, don't let the professionals screw it up. And if it ever gets off the rails, pick up the phone and have a conversation with the seller. Because at the end of the day, you two are the ones doing this deal, not all of us professionals. I wouldn't say that I would suggest you go ahead and call the sellers all the time. You got to work through the channels. But if anything ever gets off the rails, that's kind of a 911 button. So, So I guess that's a great place to transition. Tim, any final words as we wrap this bad boy up? I mean, you gave us a lot of knowledge here in 30, 40 minutes.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, we don't want you to call the sellers to negotiate the contract or anything else in there, but absolutely, it's a relationship. You're calling. So your first meeting with the seller is to convince the seller that you're the nicest guy to take over his patients, and he's not going to run into his patients in Safeway. They start yelling and screaming about who the crazy person is that you sold my practice to. So, you know, your first job is to convince the seller that you're the nicest guy in the world, and you're going to take care of these relationships that this guy's cultivated for 40 years. After that, negotiations usually become easier. And like Mike said, if it gets off the rails, make that phone call again and just convince a guy, hey, I'm still the same guy. And you see, the problem is the seller is going to attribute all these changes that the attorney's doing to you. He's going to assume you're the CEO. So you may have to disown that, you know, and of course saying, well, you know, I got to listen to my guy because he's my attorney. That's not going to cut it, to be honest with you. You need to get that relationship back and just kind of say, okay, what do we need to talk about here? And what are the concerns? And because we want, so anyway, my point is I want you to become best friends with my client. I'm always amazed that these buyers don't call up and hang out and then go to lunch and hang out in the office or do whatever. To me, if I'm spending anything, $250 to $1 million on a practice, I want to get to know that guy. I want to be in his back pocket for several weeks and just, you know, to have that happen. And I don't see a lot of buyers do that. I'm always perplexed, yeah. You know, I mean, yeah. But I don't want them to call and negotiate the allocations or the price or anything like that anymore. But I mean, I do want them to become best friends. Exactly. So,
Yeah, that's perfect. Well, Tim, thanks so much for your time, dude. I always like working deals with you. It's always these super fun conversations we have. Wealth of knowledge, dentist yourself, 130 practices in 1 year. Imagine that over a 40 years. I know you haven't been doing it 40 years, but I mean, that's a lot of experience. So if you ever get Tim on the phone, ask him. He loves to give advice. And I think he's a good one to get advice. So Tim, thanks again for being on the program, my friend. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me. Thanks, Mike. Take care.
All right. Be good.
Tune in next time for another truth-filled episode of Acquisition Uncensored. We want to hear from you. Interact with your host, Michael Dincio. Follow us on Facebook and YouTube. Comment and subscribe.